Marianne McKenzie is a farmer and a tree campaigner saving trees. Hello, Marianne.
Hi there.
Hey, Marianne, what are the trees that you're wanting to save?
There are some red gums. There's quite a few yellow box, which are good for honey. And there's an extremely large yellow gum. And there's apple box, which are really great for microbats to live in because they're all craggy.
Where are the trees that you're wanting to save?
They're in a strip of farmland quite a distance away from the existing highway. So it's a route which has taken a deviation from the side of the existing highway on the Western Highway Duplication Project in central Victoria.
So who's wanting to? So whose land are the trees on?
Private farmland. About five different landholders.
Oh, so five. Okay. So there's a road going to go through, or a new road, or an extension to a road going through some farmland.
Yes.
And the council or Vic Roads or whoever it is that are building it are saying we're going to knock those trees down.
Yeah, they are, because big, wide roads need a big, well, especially when they go through the hills, big, wide roads need a lot of land, but they've chosen a hillier route. They're taking a deviation through the hills and leaving the existing road unused, unfortunately.
So they're not even widening the existing road, they're just going to build a whole new road.
Yeah, and the intention was to save the roadside vegetation, which is very good along there, very good quality, not actually as rare as what's in the paddocks. The vegetation in the paddocks is federally listed. It's also got the habitat of two federally listed species, a striped legless lizard, we think, and has to be treated as though it is, because with animals you can't be sure whether they just evaded you when you looked.
Marianne, the farmers whose land it is, do they get any say about what happens?
Not much. With these very large road projects, they're deemed to be so important that the public interest in having an enormous road outweighs the individual's rights.
So have they explained why it is that they can't just widen the existing road and why there has to be a new one put in?
They have said that it's they're trying to minimise overall environmental impact. However, the data that was given to the route selection panel actually included some gaps. They missed some of the finer grained plants. That's the ground cover. Not so obvious. Everyone can see the trees easily enough, but this was missed, and we've been working to present data to the authorities to say, well, actually, if you look at the overall environmental damage, all these different aspects of environmental impact, there's large trees and there's patches of ground cover and habitat, and there's the fragmentation impacts of a whole new cut, and the downstream effects when you go through a hillside with spring soaks on it and spoil the way the water flows through the ground for these rare vegetations we've got here. All those put together, it actually isn't less damage according to the independent reports we've had done. And it's just very hard to get that across.
Now, Marianne, is it mainly farmers that are driving this issue?
It's some farmers and some local Ararat residents. It's probably 50-50.
Yeah. And the farmers whose property are affected, are they supportive?
Yes, they are. So one lot don't get any compensation because their land's not actually touched. That's the law. If you don't get any land taken, you don't get any compensation, even if you get a big road next to you.
It's interesting because often we would associate this sort of a campaign to be led by environmentalists, and people would get a little bit thingy about environmentalists butting in. But it's interesting here that it's farmers there and people from regional areas that aren't necessarily just environmentalists that are recognising the importance of trees and what they are for their properties.
Well, yes, in this case, that all the different interests align on the existing highway if it's done carefully. If they did a very wide strip of damage. It would be terrible damage through there because the roadside vegetation is so good. But if they do it carefully, which is possible, using a strip of existing cleared land there, then it's farmers' interests, it's conservationists' interests, it's taxpayers' interest. And it's driver's interest because it's actually a shorter route as well.
When you take a look at when they do that sort of road work, it's not only the work that's actually on the road, it's the amount of damage that is done alongside the road. And we tend to forget how much clearing that is done when new roads are put in.
Absolutely. And we get used to trusting the authorities, and I think we're not really fully aware of the scope they do have to do different designs. And now with safety barriers becoming more usual, the scope for less damage is better recognised. But the old trees that they're planning to destroy, there really are a few spectacular ones, and they are some of the oldest living creatures in the landscape. And I know I've heard people talking about old trees in the middle of Paris, actually, and not nearly as dramatic as what we've got here that we're planning to destroy for a road that could go somewhere else.
Marianne, do you think that you're going to get some support and you might actually get some changes made?
Well, we're hopeful. It's pretty concerning when we've gathered so much data that people are still saying that the process has been followed. If it's come up with this result, it wasn't a very effective process. And we want the process to uphold the intention of the regulations and the process, which is to, in this case, to minimise the damage of this road. And
Marianne, our news is coming up, but thank you for telling us a little bit about it. If you're wanting to know more about Marianne McKenzie and the story about that bit of road work that's done between Ararat and Beaufort, something like 900 trees of significance were felled. A bit of a blunder as far as recognising the significance, the environmental impact that work would have. And if you want to find out more about that, there's a petition online. If you go to change.org, you'll be able to get more information on that story. And it's an interesting one, particularly when you take a look at the work that's done by governments, done by roadworks, and taking a look at the significant impact that happens to the environment, and especially when it's on private property as well, and that you get actually no say. So if you're wanting to get more information, you can go to WAM8 and you can find more information there and perhaps give some support to that group, because it's a good thing to do. You can't just say it's just environmentalists. This is farmers and all sorts of people from a local community concerned about their environment and the impact that sort of work can have on that. This is Overnights with Trevor Chappell on ABC Radio. Rhys Holter is our earth doctor. Hello, Rhys.
Get out here, Trev. How are you?
You love your trees.
Oh, yeah? Who doesn't?
Bees can't.
Who
bees live in trees?
Love a tree? Let me tell you, it's very suspicious if somebody does not love a tree.
You gotta love a tree. Well, they're not hurting anybody, really, are they?
No, mate. How about this? You know, let's just the first principles. Trees give us. This is what they do for us. They suck the CO2 out of the air. They store it in the wood, and they give us oxygen. In fact, it's a stunning fact. For every 1 ton of wood, 1.5 tons, metric tons, tonnies, have been pulled from the atmosphere, and 1 ton of oxygen has been given off. How good is that?
So really, we've talked about if we didn't have any bees, that life wouldn't be particularly good without bees because of the amount of work that they do. If we get rid of all of our trees, we're probably in just as much trouble as our lack of bees.
Yeah. No, if the trees die, we die. And if the bees die, we die. And if the oceans die, we die. I mean, they are ultimately Earth's life support system.
If you take a look, so let's take a look at the environmental, because you talked about what happens and the work that trees do. We see, and we've seen in all sorts of cases, the amount of trees that have been knocked down for agriculture, for mining, for all sorts of things.
Houses.
Yep. Actually, and is that probably one of the biggest things? Because we tend to place a lot of emphasis on clearing by farmers, but if you take a look at the clearing that's done for suburbs, it would be just as big an impact, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, the number one use of wood around the globe still today is fuel wood, Trevor. So in the developing countries, people wanting to eat, they're breaking down trees to cook with. And in the 70s, in Africa and elsewhere, one way to get people not to pull down the trees was to introduce the fact to some villages, not all, some new, but if they planted food-bearing trees and the people saw that the trees were giving them directly food, they protected them, particularly when they're hungry.
Hello, Del.
I'm over 80, and the school I attended in Brisbane a long while ago, we had a forestry club.
Hmm.
And Clem Ferguson was the teacher who taught us, and it was just wonderful what we learned about trees. And every Arbor Day, we used to plant more pine trees behind the principal's residence, Pinus tedra and Pinus carabea.
Hmm.
And I used to delight in adulthood, I'd go back and I could still see my trees.
Isn't that great? I loved Arbor Day, Del.
Yes, but sadly, that particular school, they got rid of the forestry to put in a swimming pool.
Yikes.
There's something cool about that. Del, what did you do in forestry club?
Oh, look, we had lectures and lessons, and we learned how to plant, how to propagate, how to plant seeds, gather seeds, plant them, because this was just after the war when shortages were the norm.
Mm.
And we learned so much, and of course I've been a gardener all my life, but I value what old Clem, as we used to call him, he wasn't old, but yeah, he looked old. I valued what he taught us, because we learned so much about planting, cultivation, pruning, and all that sort of stuff.
Del, thank you for calling, because what it does, Reece, is it highlights that environmentalism is nothing new and that we recognise the importance of trees and forests for a very, very, very long time.
Oh, yeah. And kids intuitively love that. I mean, kids know that. And today, Trevor, the difference, one difference is, instead of teaching children planting trees or collecting seeds, I'm happy to report that schools around the world are introducing gardens and children to gardens and children to how to grow food, and also be aware that the bees are our friends because they pollinate. So there is a resurgence, which is really good.
But there's something, I mean, I understand that it's nice to have gardens, but there's something different about trees to gardens. There's a longevity. And as Del said, she loved going back and seeing the trees that she planted as a child.
Yeah.
And do they ever have Arbor Day in America?
Yeah, but it's state by state. It's not a one national day, so it's really confusing, and it's a shame. And you know, more than ever, the great thing, and Aussies will know this intuitively, above and beyond everything, trees cast shade, and shade is what is the difference between life and death in heat, right? Mm. So the shade is just glorious. And let me remind you that in cities where there are trees, that shade brings the heat dome that all the concrete and the rooftops are accumulating. It can bring it down, Trev, by 4 or 5 degrees C, which is an amazing thing.
Actually, that's a good point. I never even thought about that, the impact that the shade from trees have. I never even thought about that.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, should the readers be at all interested, the listeners, I would like to draw your attention to ABC's Organic Gardener. The September issue has a great article by Dr. Bob Brown on the spirituality of trees, and it also has a very long article by Dr. Reese Halter on fighting for our forests.
we'll talk more about that in a second, but that's another thing, is it's a recognition from Indigenous cultures of how important trees are, in that they're regarded in very, very highly.
Huge, huge. And let's not also forget, please, the trees give us some of the most potent medicines, heart medicines, pain medicines, cancer medicines. They're incredible. And amongst us all, I don't think you'll find anybody who doesn't eat, right? There's a lot of great food. My apples come from trees. There's 7,500 different kinds of varieties of apples around the globe, and the most consumed fruit is our mangoes.
Let's go. Oh, we've got a board full of calls wanting to hug trees with us.
Okay.
Jules, good morning.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple of things about trees. Main thing is they produce oxygen, and that's what we live on.
Yep.
And secondly, they produce food, as your guests were saying, apples, mangoes, all sorts of fruits. But my neighbour, who I was with the other day, is replanting maple trees. And I said, what are you doing this for? And he said, well, they're great air conditioners. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I put them over the doorways. They grow everywhere. In the summer, they have leaves, which cools the place. In the winter, they lose their leaves and they let the sun in, which warms the place.
I know, and it's perfect.
They're natural air conditioners.
Yeah, it is such a good point. And they do a great job of that, Reese.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. And also, they give us some pretty kick spices. I love my cinnamon.
Reese, because we've talked about the thing is, though, in some cultures they need firewood, or they are now finding ways within those cultures that they don't need to be able to chop down trees for firewood? Or is that then more just to do with maintenance and maintaining forests and maintaining areas for firewood?
Food, but you know, there was a great article yesterday in the ABC online. And it pertains not so much, not directly to chopping trees, but more to how glorious the new technology, the solar panels and the batteries, the battery storage systems are, enabling farmers in WA and elsewhere around the nation to go off grid and successfully be able to weather conditions where the power would be interrupted. So one great thing I believe on technology is it's going to help people in all over the globe have the ability to cook without pulling down the trees, because we're losing too many trees.
And increasingly we're seeing changes in farming practices to recognise the importance of trees, not only for shade, but also for wind blocks and for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, in addition to helping the water table too, Trev, we find that when we've got trees, the water table actually comes up. It obviously casts shade, but and homes for critters. But it's a community rather than this notion once upon a time that everything had to be one, the mono plant and everything else had to be done with. We're bringing it back. And when we bring it back, when we have clumps of trees in the fields and we're working around them, it really does work better.
Spud, good morning.
Yeah, another thing trees do is their roots hold the ground together.
Yeah, which means that you don't lose the...
I heard some years ago, is it true that trees attract rain clouds?
Oh, nice question. Reese, do we know if trees attract rain clouds?
Absolutely right, 110%. When
we have forests, they alter the microclimate. They actually do create their own rain. And that, it, again, I direct the readers, please, if you're at all interested, in the ABC Organic Gardener September edition on the stands right now, I go to great lengths and tell the readers why the Amazon forest, how magnificent it is, because it actually does. It's a rain-making machine, and we need it. And also, the interesting thing is the clouds that they create, the rain, daily rain clouds they create, act as a beautiful reflective cover. So when the sun hits the cloud, the white clouds, it reflects it back to space rather than hitting the land and warming it up.
But the other point that he made, though, the important role that trees and plants have in actually holding soil together so that we don't have the runoff that occurs too is incredibly important.
Absolutely. And this, again, highlights what happened last month, Trev, which was an epic, unprecedented disaster up in the Bay of Carpentaria. Half on the Queensland side, half on Northern Territory side. We lost 10,000 hectares of mangroves. We've never seen a death as widespread ever. My colleagues have never seen this. And the reporters commented on it. What they did forget, sadly, to tell the audience, which I've told, the mangroves hold the soil. They grow right on the ocean's edge, the bay's edge, and they hold the soil onto the land. Now that the trees are dead, the next cyclone season, when it barrels in, it will remove thousands of tons of topsoil into the water. And, of course, the barramundis and the shrimps and the lobsters will die and have died without those trees.
Let alone the mud crabs. And there are going to be a lot of people very sad if they don't have mud crabs for dinner.
Oh.
I like a muddy. Lydia, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes,
Lydia. What about the trees, the roots that absorb contaminants to the willow tree?
Ah, I didn't even think of that as well.
Yes, that's true. And also, what about the message that the Olympic Games opening ceremony had? They had the flag bearer, a child carrying a little tree. And as they went to their stations where they had to wait, the leader planted a little seed in a pod. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that's a great idea. Lydia, Wonderful. Thank you. Now, I've got to point out we're going to cross to find out what's happening in Rio in a couple of minutes' time. But, Reese, tell us about the root systems and how they actually absorb contaminants.
Yeah, this is a third of all cities, or more than one-third of all cities and towns on planet Earth, depend upon forest catchments to provide their water. And you see, the tree roots are the most perfect filtration system that we know of to pull the toxins out of that are landing from the airborne into the soil and hold them there and release water that's potable, that's drinkable. There's no chlorination system that even comes close, a water system, to our native natural forests. They are priceless, is how good they are.
Reese, does that mean that they manage to survive and still take in all of those toxins?
To a degree, I mean, you know, yes, they can handle some toxicity, but if we continue to hit it too hard, of course, the forests die back, and we've seen die back everywhere and more. We've seen massive tree deaths all over Australia and around the world, from Tasmania to the, how do I pronounce it, Kumamonero, New South Wales, to around the Perth area. We've got massive die-offs of trees because it's too hot and too dry. So they reach a tipping point, Trev.
And, of course, disease, things like dieback, which has had a tremendous impact on the forests around Western Australia as well.
Yeah, Yeah, and the Cockies, the Carnaby Cockies, are done because, you know, the thing people need to remember is in nature, when you lose your home, your forest, you die as a critter.
And that's the whole, the circle of life that we have to remember as well.
Yeah, because there's only so much room to hold stuff. Right?
One of the important things that we also remember that if we're going to wanting to take things away, especially in third world countries, then we have to provide other options to those people as well. You can't just say, well, no, you can't clear land anymore. You can't have trees for fire anymore. You can't have things for cooking anymore. So to be able to do that, you need to be able to provide alternatives, which is really, really important. Because what we find in Western culture is that we say, no, you can't do that because we've done it. I've got a nice text here saying, not being rude, but cow's poo can be burnt for heating and also be made into bricks for housing. So it's not as if there aren't alternatives to trees.
Yeah, oh, no, there are many alternatives, and we just have to be careful. And I mean, this all boils down, I believe, to one thing. When I was born, there were approximately, give or take, 2.9 billion people. Trev, whether people understand it, want to understand it, or otherwise, there's 7.4 billion people. Sadly, but true, they all want the American dream. They all want a McMansion. They all want four cars. They all want possibly an airplane and everything else. We're using 160% more of the resources on planet Earth than our home, Earth, can support us. So we either continue as business as usual, and that has a terrible end, or we all pull back. I know nobody wants to hear that, but that's the truth. And if we look at what's happened in the ocean or on the land, you can see it. Everybody can see it. So it's very difficult. It means we all have to get along with a little less. I'm sure the consumer associations will be at me for that.
And it's also little things add up to big things. Okay, that we will talk to you on another occasion about the use of hemp. But there are things that we can now use hemp for instead of using trees. We can do what we did make products for paper for before from trees. We can now do hemp.
Yeah.
And we need to start looking at those alternatives.
Yeah, we do need to encourage those. Again, kudos to you. It's sensible. Not only does hemp, by the way, make paper, but it turns out that hemp seed packs a protein punch that leaves everything in its dust. In America, in the 20s or the 10s, some whiskey boys came up with the notion that hemp was the devil. And therefore, would you believe, we're not allowed to have it. So I eat hemp and I have to import it from the Great White North up in Canada. It costs a fortune. We could grow a gazillion tons of it in California.
Russ joins us. Hello, Russ.
I was wondering if you knew about the impact of feral cats on trees.
Tell us about it.
Well, up around Marysville in Victoria, that's where I was born.
Beautiful place, Marysville, too.
Certainly is. There are mites that actually attack the eucalyptus trees, and the frogs normally eat those mites and keep them under control. However, with so many feral cats, the feral cats are eating the frogs, and so the mites are killing the trees.
That impact is being noticed in the area a lot?
Oh, you can see it, yeah, for sure. There's dead trees everywhere.
And is anything being done about it?
I have no idea.
Bloody feral cats.
Yeah, I know. There's about 9 million in Victoria, apparently.
Yeah. Look, thank you. I mean, this is a really good example of how the cycle can be broken and interrupted by something like cats, which then affects frogs, which then affects mites, which then affects trees.
Yeah, mate, and all this boils down to something, Trevor, that's very, very close to my heart. Stop 1080 poison. 1080 poison is the most heinous poison. We even banned it in America. Come on. And the 1080 poison, which kills everything. And by the way, when an animal in Australia eats 1080 poison, they are electrocuted for 48 hours before they die. It is inhumane. Why do they use 1080 poison, you ask, Dr. Reese? I'll tell you, to kill dingoes. Dingoes are the largest land predator in Australia. That makes them an apex predator. So if you kill all the dingoes, and by the way, in 20 years, the rate that this is happening, there'll be no more dingoes. So when you kill all the dingoes as an apex predator, everything underneath it crumbles. Hello, you have a feral cat problem, allow the dingoes to eat the cats. This is not quantum physics.
Now,
this
Reece,
is shocking, and it's ecocide.
Now, Reece, you do know that there are questions asked about what dingoes are and whether or not feral dogs are breeding with dingoes and if we actually have any dingoes left in Australia.
There are dingoes. For, you know what? That is, Trevor, that is the rancher's way to kill. So let's say, okay, let's say you are correct. So should we kill every wild dog in Australia? Moreover, here's another question. Should we kill every Brumby? Because they're doing that on Kosciuszko. 6,000 Brumbies, they're going to wipe off the planet. Should we kill everything so it satisfies humans? And then you'll have more feral cats. This is shocking, mate.
We'll go back to trees. Good morning, Peter.
Trevor, you might have probably realised that for the last 50 or 60 or more years, we've had a salinity problem in the Murray River. Now, you've also had a big problem in your home state, Western Australia.
Salinity is a huge issue.
Yeah, now...
This all comes down to water tables and all sort of things, Peter.
Yeah. Now there is a red gum, which is commonly known as the Lake Albicutcha red gum, which has been growing around the Lake Albicutcha in Victoria for many, many years. And it actually can survive in 40% saline water.
I remember doing a thing about this when I was just out of uni, actually taking a look at salinity levels and the impact that certain plants can have and certain trees can have on the reduction of salinity levels, and this may be one of them.
Yeah, this is the one, and well, this is one of the greatest ones. It's been described as the CSIRO described it, the Lake Albicutcha red gum as of global significance and priceless because of its great adaptability and its value to conservation and forestry.
And Peter, are they being used enough around that area?
Well, Lake Albicutcha, I don't know if you know where it is or not, but it's in the Wimmera.
Mm.
And I don't think anybody has really utilised this tree enough. It needs to be, the seed needs to be collected and we need to grow thousands and thousands of them and plant them in areas like that area I was talking about in West Australia.
Yeah, because there was some research being done by one of the large mining companies in southern Western Australia into working on water tables and salinity and the use of trees and local trees to do that.
Yeah, well, Dr. Leon Breen in Cresset Campus in the University of Melbourne, he's done a lot of research on it. I don't know whether he's still there or not, but he is one person who knows a lot about it. And you know, it's described as the Rolls Royce of red gums.
Peter, thank you. This is an example of how the environment can look after itself. And water tables and salinity levels are very, very detrimental as far as trees are concerned in many areas.
Huge, huge, particularly the Murray-Darling Basin. And by the way, Leon, I believe, is retired. I know Leon. He's a wonderful fellow and he is a fountain of knowledge on the red gums. And that was one of his areas of expertise. We do need to be using the eucalypts in the different parts of Australia that have, as you mentioned, adapted to these conditions, because salt in the soil is end game. And by the way, that's how the Romans, when they went through and they wanted to wipe their enemy off the map, they salted the soil so people couldn't grow food.
Yeah. I know someone said I'm a liar because I said I didn't go to uni. I said I never passed anything at uni. I went to a few. Never passed anything, though. Good morning, Peter.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up how trees can remove toxic metals from soil. While I was doing my master's, I came across an example where olive trees were used to remove lead from around mine sites.
Olive trees?
Olive trees, yeah. You couldn't consume the olives afterwards, but what they did was they grew the olive trees around the mine site, and then they'd cut the olive trees down and dump the timber into the mine because it couldn't be used. But what it then did is it locked up the lead in the timber.
Yeah, and but do you know why they used olive trees? Was that just because they do absorb so much, or that they just grew well in that area?
Probably because they grew well in the area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some people would say, Reece, that maybe you shouldn't have the mining there and actually producing that amount of lead. However, it's an indication of how you can use a natural resource to actually reduce the amount of toxins.
Too right. Too right. And obviously, again, it has to be done if the mine is justified and the mineral is being used in something else, like our computers or our smartphones or tablets or wherever.
Yeah.
We need to work with nature.
Nice text here from Mick saying, straw bale homes, no need for wood. If a steel frame is used and for fires, I find enough wood in the ground without felling trees. I mean, that's a good example, too, of just looking at what we have in the environment. Go on, Reece.
No, I was going to say, they're wonderful. The straw bale homes are magnificent. Their value is as high as anything that we can make, and they're great. Huge fan.
Stan, good morning.
I'm in the Tunnara area, and I've got a tree here. It's like 13 metres round, and I estimate probably 3,000 years old, but the Department of Lands just want to come in and knock it over to get a few tonnes of gravel from growing under, that's underneath it. You know what I mean? I really need someone to try and help me protect it.
Yeah, what are they getting support from local groups, Stan?
No, not really. I'm just trying to stop the Department of Lands coming in here pushing up gravel on a tree. I reckon it's 3,000 years old, this tree. It's one of the older trees in Australia. And I just reckon, you know, a tree of that age should be protected, you know.
Have you spoken to your local council and to other local people about it?
I've spoken to the Department of Environment Protection, and they just reckon that they're not protected, the boa tree, and, you know, and that's their attitude. But like a tree of that age, and it's 13 metres around. It's absolutely enormous, this tree.
You should have a chat with... You just heard us talking to Marianne about how they're saving trees in their area. You should have a chat with people like that to find out how they go about creating change.
Yeah, I'll have to do a bit more. Like, even the greenies, try and get the greenies to come and try and help me save
them. Absolutely.
I'm sure you'll find a couple of them, Stan.
Thanks.
Good on you. Thank you. Boab trees are beautiful trees, Reece.
Oh, they're wonderful. Look, the Bob Brown Foundation would help. The Australian Conservation Foundation would help. Any of the foundations, if Stan reaches forth to them, they'll help, because these ancient trees are invaluable and most so worthy of protection.
Lee, you'll be our last caller. Hello, Lee.
This is only a very short story. To that gentleman, what they should say to everybody, the lungs of the earth are trees. Without trees, we all die. It's the lungs of the earth. I was told this many years ago, and I've always remembered this saying, and it's so simple. We just have to tell people it's the lungs of the earth. And people don't understand that we don't have trees, we all die. As simple as that, they're the lungs of the earth. That's, and I don't know why people can't. It's a simple thing.
Lee, it's
get it over.
Lee, it's the thing that makes us breathe. Reece, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much today.
Thanks very much. And the Organic Gardener September issue, please.
Dr. Reece Holter, our Earth Doctor. You're listening to Overnights with Trevor Chappell on ABC Radio.